Oh. Okay. I'll see what I can do to do that. Okay, it's paused recording.
Okay, it's 1:30. Good afternoon, everyone. Let's call this meeting to order. This is the January 24th, 2022 meeting of the Board of Commissioners, Clallam PUD number one. Our first item of business is approval of a consent agenda. We only have three items. There's minutes for two meetings. And claim vouchers from January the 10th through January the 18th.
Unless Jim has any questions, I move that we approve the consent agenda.
I'll second the motion.
All right, it's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda for January the 24th, 2022. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. Agenda revision. Sean, do we have any?
None today, Will.
Great, thank you. Comments from the public. T, I think you're going to...
Yes, if anybody from the public would like to speak, please raise your hand or let me know. And I have...
Before you do that, T, I just wanted to note for the record that we received three letters, one from the Port of Port Angeles, one from the City of Forks, and one from the City of Sequim, all related to the Bonneville Power contract. And I have forwarded all of those letters to the commissioners and also given them to records for logging.
Okay, thank
you,
Sean.
Thank you, Sean. And for public comment, we have Mark Lozias.
Yes, Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, commissioners. I appreciate the time this morning. Very briefly, I just wanted to put the hand in the air for the Clallam commissioners as well with a request, as Sean just mentioned, from several other stakeholders for doing some stakeholder outreach ahead of your decision on the post-28 BPA contract. I know you're aware of the issues that are of concern, so I won't spend any more time going over them today. But for the future of economic development in our county, we really would love some consideration for alternatives and some ability to have input into the planning process. So you can expect to receive from the Clallam commissioners next week a similar letter of request for consideration for doing stakeholder outreach and engagement ahead of this decision. That's what I had to say. Thank you very much again for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity. Take care.
Okay, Mark. Thank you. You know, I just have to add, there are no contracts in hand at this point. We're participating in trying to influence that process through a number of organizations, WAPEG, PPC, WAPUTA, and others. But as of yet, we have no indication of what those contracts are going to look like. So anyway, when we do, we'll certainly bring it before the public. Do we have others, T?
I am not seeing any other public comment.
Okay, thank you. Well, we'll move on to business items. The first is the Economic Development Council presentation. Colleen, you're on.
Great, so, thank you very much.
Go ahead, Colleen.
Thank you. I will, Commissioner Purser. And so may I share screen, or T, are you able to pull up the PowerPoint?
I can pull it up, or I can share whichever you prefer.
I guess I'll, if you don't mind sharing, I've got it pulled up here. That would be
okay.
Great. Thank you.
You should be able to share.
Let's see. not letting me do it yet.
Okay.
She still says disabled.
Okay. Well, then maybe I will share, and you can just tell me to move on when you need the screen to be on.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Other than trying to figure it out. Okay,
there it is.
There it is. Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Clallam County PUD commissioners. I appreciate this opportunity, and I will try to move through this fairly quickly because I'm sure you know a lot about our organization. But if you'll move to the next slide, please. Next slide.
Okie dokie.
So first of all, I reiterate our mission statement because in the past, our EDC has not focused on partnership, and we truly believe that the EDC can be a much stronger organization for our county and for the citizens and the municipalities within our county if we partner with the other great organizations that are here. So we make a very concerted effort to do that with our chambers, with Center for Inclusive Entrepreneurship, with the SBDC and NODC and others. We do manage the North Olympic Legislative Alliance for Clallam and Jefferson Counties, which is focused on state legislative issues, but we only work on nonpartisan issues. So next slide, please. So sometimes people ask what we do, and I know it's a myriad of things, so I wanted to highlight how we see our work areas, and that's supporting individual businesses with referrals, business-to-business introductions, and real estate advising. We also market Clallam County to site selectors and others through expos, conferences, and sending out marketing packages, which are always being modified and targeted to different area entities and based on the product, the land that's being promoted. We also, like I said, manage the North Olympic Legislative Alliance. And Nicole Hartman has been your representative on that in the past. We have a lobbyist, Josh Weiss, who used to be the government affairs director for the Washington Association of Counties. And so he's very adept in all the legislative processes in Olympia. We are in the midst of doing a 5-year economic plan. We've been surveying individuals looking for people that are of employment. In employment that are not retired, and asking them about their view of their financial capacity and their quality of life. And we're also working with surveying over 300 different businesses trying to understand where there's opportunity in the supply chain so that can be served locally instead of purchasing goods out and services outside of our area. We're going to be surveying at least five, we already have surveyed over 500 individuals across the county relating to their belief as to how they're doing financially. And we administer the Clallam County Opportunity Fund board process on behalf of the county. Of course, county commissioners make that final decision, but we manage the applications and the board process, the advisory board process. We also manage the Child Care Alliance for Clallam County. We previously assessed resources and identified gaps. We have received a follow-on grant for that, and so I'll be talking about that in our work areas for 2022. We also have been managing a procurement technical assistance counselor in Clallam County, and I want to thank your staff for participating in our different presentations that we do to businesses so that they can know what the public works opportunities are in Clallam County regarding Clallam PUD public works projects. Next slide. We are contracted by the state and designated by the county as the county's, Collin County's economic agency. We act as boots on the ground on behalf of the Department of Commerce. This is referred to as the ADO or the Associate Development Office for Collin County. Every county has one. Commerce views ADO as evidence of community support and involvement for grant applications, such as ones that would be of interest to Collin PUD, which are the Clean Energy Fund, Public Works Board project funding, curb funding, electrification of transportation systems, or energy retrofits for public buildings. So if you are ever applying for any of those types of grants, please turn to us, and we will solicit support and help you get letters of support so that you have a strong application in those regard, in that regard. We have boards of directors. Two-thirds of our board represent businesses from each of the major industry sectors, such as hospitality, legal, banking, nonprofit, manufacturing, construction, healthcare, personal services, retail, etc. And a third of our board members are government leaders from the county, the cities of Sequim, Port Angeles, and Forks, PUD, the port, and tribes. We have three full-time permanent employees. We have four part-time project-focused employees and four contractors that work on our behalf. Next slide, please. So this is an example of where one of our part-time project employees were doing interviews of people that are employees in our county, assessing how they view our economy, their financial viability, and quality of life issues. And so we'll be producing the results of those surveys, and it'll be part of our county 5-year countywide economic plan, and should be out soon. Next slide, please. So I've talked about some of this, but that strategic planning process with surveys, 60% of those are out of Port Angeles. And employer surveys, about 60% are in Port Angeles area as well. That's based on a pro rata distribution. We do marketing and recruitment, of course, for Clallam County. We've had the Choose Clallam First campaign, where there's nearly 9,000 recipients that receive our social media and website newsletters. And we also have in 2021, we pursued 15 businesses to locate in Clallam County. Many were large power users, and we won 3 of those. And I can get into more of that going forward here. Events and training, of course, some of them, 2 of 3 are in the city limits of Port Angeles. But one is a very large power user out in Forks that is in the process of being developed, and your staff, again, has worked with this business entity. Events and training, we do our weekly Coffee with Colleen meetings. This Wednesday, I just put out a newsletter that Senator Cantwell will be joining us, and she is going to talk about the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, where, of course, just that being the topic, there's a lot of different funding opportunities that the Clallam PUD may have interest in learning more about and asking questions of her. We do training. I just recently did a statewide training class on procurement and on rather buying and selling a business, what's it worth? And then also we do our public work training for contractors and consultants. I've talked about NOLA, the North Olympic Legislative Alliance, for the two counties. We set priorities, and our lobbyist is working on those. They are extending the .09 fund program, which is about $40 million annually across the state that remains it in rural counties. Another priority was completion of the Elwha Bridge replacement. We think those first two were very doable, and we expect a success in that regard. The third one is a broader set of issues, which is topics around the unique issues that rural communities face, such as workforce housing and prevailing wages in public works contracts being essentially the same in our county as they are in King County. Yet, obviously, our median wage is nowhere near what King County's is. And then also, we completed the Child Care Alliance, the report on resources and gaps assessment. So we know exactly what child care resources are out there and where they're not. Column Bay CQ is an absolute desert, and we are working now to try to create resources in those areas. Next slide, please. Just some highlights of what we were able to achieve in 2021. Our membership revenues more than doubled since 2019. Number of memberships increased by 31% since 2020. Our social media and newsletter reach grew by 18% in 2021. We completed successfully our federal audit and our financial statement audit, which was the first time that I know of that the EDC had completed that. So that was a big lift, and we're really excited that we did not get any findings, and it was a successful audit. We've been supporting policy issues, such as the ones around restaurant owners, and we've assessed Clallam County's economy. Again, completion of over 700 employee and employer surveys. We've hired Dr. Dan Underwood, who is a PhD economist, who's very familiar with our county's economy, and he is helping us write that plan and helped us write the survey questions. We partnered with Peninsula College in those surveys so that we were hitting two birds with one stone when we talked to all the business owners so that we could glean some information for Peninsula College is regarding what their workforce needs were. And we work on attracting businesses that pay well. We developed, 15 marketing packages for multiple locations and sites. We won Stabycraft, which is a business that will hire 45 employees. They pay high wages, and we have two others that are in progress, one of which would be a Clallam PUD customer and up to 200 employees out in the Forks area. Next slide, please. This is a quick snapshot of our social media and our newsletter. I won't go into that, but we've got a lot of followers there. Next slide, please. So key programs for 2022, we're going to complete that five-year countywide economic plan, and we really are looking forward to working with the PUD because there are some things related to power that have prevented us from being able to attract high-wage paying businesses, such as the new large single load restrictions and being able to buy off the green power grid and availability of power purchase agreements. And another issue is Mino Carbon was a business that had selected Clallam County, and they really do want to locate in the Port Angeles area, somewhere between Port Angeles and Sequim. They want to put their research facility there. It'll be about a $5 million investment, but they need, for a larger plant to be located there, they need about 50 acres of heavy industrially zoned property, which the county currently doesn't have. So they'll just put their research facility in our county. Obviously, housing and child care and workforce are always barriers that we need to work on together. We want to achieve significant input from our stakeholders through the ClallamEDCConnections.com site, which is the engagement platform for our five-year economic plan. And if there were any reason why the PUD would want to use that site, it's created exactly for online engagement. We could create a subset of that site, a page for Clallam PUD, where you could get request input from Clallam County citizens. It's monitored, it's curated, and it's got great tools that allow information to be shared with different entities that are responsible for different parts of a an engagement plan. We are, like I said, doing more of these training events, and we have our annual EDC gala on March 18th. We've got Bob Donegan, the Ivers Seafood CEO, as a keynote speaker, and we're working on opportunities and to develop the east side of Squim, the Forks Industrial Park. We're looking at TIF, transportation infrastructure funding, and of course, the Infrastructure and Job Act money that Congressman Kilmer can come. He has offered to attend PUD meetings, as an example. He's going to be attending the port meeting and talking to us about different federal funding opportunities that we might want to pursue. And then also, we are pursuing over $100,000 per year for Procurement Technical Assistance Center funding, that where we will match some of those funds, and they'll be for small startup businesses to start engaging in procurement, public works contracts, so safety consultants, flaggers, hydro seeding, that kind of thing. That money is now exported out to businesses in the I-5 corridor, and if we had small businesses that had that skill set, that money could be staying here locally. Next slide, please. Just a quick look on city and county economic data. Next slide. This is an example of the retail sales. The most recent amount of retail income that came in by city in 2021. This is comparing, this is actually all second quarter. I'm sorry, I didn't change that. Second quarter year over year. And you'll see, though, that there is a huge increase in Forks, Squim, and Port Angeles. Forks had a 43.6% increase. Squim had a 30% increase. Port Angeles had a 22.6% increase. But as you know, Amazon and Walmart.com and that kind of thing that do deliveries, that and since people received all sorts of federal funding and unemployment funding, people had a lot of money in their pockets. And this is reflective of the funds that the money that was spent also with Amazon and Walmart. They do not show that if it's an online order that it came from an outside entity. So if you bought a pair of shoes off of Amazon, it would just show as apparel and be located in the apparel bucket. So that doesn't mean that it was purchased locally. It could have been purchased off of Amazon, not a local business owner. Next slide, please. This is the same picture, same quarter over quarter, quarter two, which is the most recent. And so within the county limits, where generally speaking, there isn't as much retail, the number of retail sales went up. And again, that is primarily because of online orders such as Amazon and Walmart.com, Target.com, et cetera. Next slide. 25 years of employment rates, probably not too shocking here. What I wanted to highlight is the highest between the state, Clallam and Jefferson has always been Clallam County. Our unemployment rates are always higher, and that's true today as well. Next slide. What I found interesting here about the monthly labor market changes is that our civilian force between October and November, when I submitted these slides, this was the most recent data, the total number in the civilian labor market did increase. So we're starting to see a increase of people being willing, coming back into the job market. Next slide. And here's a three-year look at the labor force. I wanted to reference this because November 2019 was pre-pandemic. And the green bar is Clallam County. Jefferson's is the yellow. As you can tell, our county has a lot more people employed than Jefferson County does. Our county represents 70% of the total population between the two counties, but it's a little bit more than that in the workforce category. But what is of interest here to me is that in November 2019, we had 28,970 people in the labor force, and in November 2021, we're past that. So we certainly had a big drop in the people that were either looking for work or were working, but now we're back up higher than we were 2 years ago. Next slide, please. And so this is just look at the change year over year. And you can see in Jefferson, the change was even more extreme than in Clallam County. Ours was more stable. Next slide. Grant administration, just very quickly, we've been processing the Lifeboat 3 grant. Next slide. Just one slide on this. This is the amount of grant funding that we distributed through our office. Of course, there were other grant programs at the state level or with chambers, but through the EDC, we distributed $2.155 million in 2020. And in 2021, through the Lifeboat Grant Program, we distributed $2.608 million. 176 businesses with an average grant amount of $14,819. Next slide. So here's again us doing interviews and surveying at the grocery stores. We chose grocery stores because we wanted to get a random sampling of individuals across our county, and everybody's got to shop at a grocery store. So that was our methodology of trying to get a randomized sample of employees in our county. So next slide. We were to work on recruiting and marketing, and we did that. Our county contract required 12 different activities, and we had 39 in 2021. Next slide. Business retention and expansion. This is, having individual meetings with businesses across our county. And I outlined it by different districts, by minority, veteran women. That's all a requirement in our contract with the state. And we had individual meetings helping with different purposes, different reasons. 211 across the county, and in our 2021 contract, the requirement was 60. But because of the Lifeboat 2 grant, we were able to do quite a bit of outreach. If you're handing out money, they want to talk to you. So when we would work with them, we would often, if they said we're having trouble, we're worried about closing, then we would dive in much deeper with them about what we could do, what resources were out there, how we could possibly help that business survive beyond just the Lifeboat 3 grant. Next slide, please. And this is startup activities, the activities for initial contact and then also follow-ups. We work very closely with the Center for Inclusive Entrepreneurship. Their office is just right next door to us, and we share our furniture and that kind of thing with them. And we use them basically as a outreach partner with us, that if it is a startup, we do a bit of support with them, but the deep dive is always with the Center for Inclusive Entrepreneurship, with either Rick or Micah Jonette, that are both great business advisors. Next slide, please. This is no longer a requirement with the state contract. The state contract goes from July 1st through June 30th, but it's being eliminated in our current contract, but we do readiness and capacity building with different entities across our county. Next slide. And this is, the last slide was a picture of programs where we were the leader and initiated those. And this is where we just had involvement and attended, basically. Next slide. And we're now working on export assistance. So we are really trying to focus a lot on that and getting businesses to sell their products outside of not just our county. To me, export assistance is if they sell to Seattle, that's great. Let's bring Seattle money to our county. But from the state's perspective, it needs to be outside of the state. So frequently we're helping with exporters to Asia, but also to Victoria and Canada. Next slide. And training, again, we have training requirements that's new for 2022. Next slide. Any questions? We are really excited and happy to work with the PUD regarding our five-year plan and how the power providers and what opportunities are out there and who we're trying to pursue, how we can partner with the PUD to make sure that we have flexibility and the ability to attract these big power users going into the next decade.
Elaine, this is Rick. I want to thank you for the presentation. One thing that you had talked about with respect to the new large single load issue with respect to the Bonneville Power Administration, it's true that there are some constraints there, but almost anywhere else they would a potential business would go, unless they went to, say, Puget Sound Energy's control area, they would run across the same constraint. So it's not like it's a unique constraint for Clallam County. It is a constraint for any utility that lives in the Bonneville control area.
So is there a possibility of having in the future, instead of a 100% load following of the BPA, having some percentage be of the load that the PUD purchases be outside of that so that there's more flexibility for those businesses?
I think you mean, is there the possibility of having generation from someone other than Bonneville, not load? We have the load.
Yeah.
And as we're, you know, we're, the new contracts start in 2028. And I think decisions don't have to be made until 2025. So, Doug and Sean have put together a plan with respect to having outreach and meeting with the public. But I think, at least this is my perspective, that engaging at this point might be a little premature since it's 3 years out. Now, I'm not saying that we can't do that, but we have been working on a schedule and plans on outreach to the public, so we understand the importance of that.
Well, that's great. Tripp, go ahead.
Yeah, Rick, I'd like to comment to that because, as Will mentioned, the influencing of BPA about what shapes these contracts is taking place now. In fact, it took place over the last year. And I think it's really important to get this kind of input that Colleen's talking about, what the mayors have sent us in the letters. It's also relevant to our strategic plan that we said we wanted to do a deep dive on this spring. And as I observed what went on with the North Olympic Development Council's presentations last fall about the demographics of our workforce and so forth, it's essential that we understand how to bring businesses in to help offset some of the residential loads that will allow us to bring in more solar and other renewables like batteries. So I think now is actually the best time to engage with stakeholder workshops and so forth, because we want to get be influencing the action and before the die is cast. And And I personally feel like we're already behind the power curve in that regard. Yeah, we won't see contracts, you know, probably for another couple of years, but the real influencing, the real work with WAPAG, you know, that we can bring from our stakeholder work groups to WAPAG and WAPUTA and others is we got to be doing that now. So I would, you know, prefer we move out on some stakeholder workshops.
All right. Colleen, thanks for the great presentation. Congratulations on your accomplishments over this past year. I'm glad to see that you've got some efforts there for business retention. We've had mixed results of trying to attract business to Clallam County, but, you know, given the pandemic and the supply chain problems and employee problems and on, I'd be interested to know how many small businesses have actually we've lost over this past difficult year and a half or so. And get into this other issue, and then I'll give you a chance to answer. Sorry. we have to accept that Clallam County is a small to medium-sized utility. Our load is less than 1% of Bonneville's total output by far. So we can try to influence these things, but we have to do that through public power organizations. And we have to be in sync with those public power organizations in order to be effective. So I'm all for having presentations to our stakeholders, getting public input. We do that anyway, and we certainly plan to do it. But let's be realistic about our degree of influence over Bonneville and the region's power supply. Anyway, back to how many businesses we've lost? Do you have that number?
Well, we certainly have a lot of anecdotal information. The information that I track is off of the Department of Revenue, and the number of businesses in our county year over year they report really late. So 2019 to 2020 was reduced from, I can get you the exact numbers, but it had been 6,700 total businesses, but that also includes businesses that make less than $12,000 per year, so they don't have to report, they don't have to pay any money to DOR, but that dropped by over 1,000 from 2019 to the end of 2020. They haven't produced any information yet in 2021. But I can certainly send you I'll put the link in the chat here in just a few minutes, and you can see what the difference is. So we have had a lot of businesses close, but the vast majority of those were in the category of less than $12,500 per year in revenues that did not have to report to DOR. So, you know, if you started up your own consulting business and it was kind of on ice, a lot of those ended up closing. And the rest, the majority were also not monthly reporters or even quarterly reporters, but annual reporters. So, again, you have to the number of times you have to report in a year is based on the revenues that you bring in. And so it was those smaller businesses, by and large, that were closing in 2020.
Yeah, I know discussions at the chamber meetings have centered around businesses that need to revise their business plan. I hope you offer that kind of assistance. But,
oh, sure.
Okay.
We absolutely do. And that's usually the chambers referred to us. And then we do the more business aspect of that work and on behalf of the chambers.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Okay, thanks a lot, Colleen.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to our next item. We have Solar Washington Organization information. Matthias, I think you have that one.
Yeah, hello. This is Matthias here, and I don't know if I can get to share my screen. I have a few quick slides here, or if you
can... should be able to, Matthias. Why don't you give it a try?
Second here. I don't see that. Hold up, I apologize. No, I can't because somebody else is sharing right now.
T, you need to stop sharing your screen.
See, I think we're seeing yours.
Yeah.
Just opened up.
Yeah, so go up to the stop screen sharing. There you go. Now you should be good, Matthias.
Just a sec here. See if I can. I guess you'll see the second slide too, but this should work here. So yeah, Solar Washington. So Solar Washington is a nonprofit organization comprised of people, companies, programs, and organizations joining together to advance solar energy in Washington. It's an industry, an association of solar energy equipment manufacturers, system integrators, distributors, dealers, designers, installers, etc. As an industry group, generally their focus is on rooftop solar as opposed to utility scale. I doubt they're opposed to large-scale solar, but my interactions with them over the years has primarily shown that the primary focus is on rooftop solar. Go move a little fast there. For the $350 sponsorship fee, we would get an acknowledgement listed on the website as a business member that includes our logo and link to our website. Plus, we can add a short description of our organization on their website, as well as getting periodic e-newsletters. There's also an ethics policy that we'd have to review and adhere to, but I think that'd be pretty straightforward. And currently, both Clark Public Utilities and Snohomish County PUD are public power organizations that are sponsoring Solar Washington. Their premier event is the Solar Summit that they've hosted since 2005. It's an important event that hosts information about and networking for the solar industry and stakeholders like manufacturers, installers, utilities, etc., where the Solar Summit attempts to tackle the most timely issues, the most talked about conversations surrounding solar energy and solar options in Washington. I attended their event in 2016, and I thought it was quite informative and a useful event. The sponsors of the last Solar Summit this year, or I guess it's last year, 2021, was Snohomish County PUD and Seattle City Light, as well as Puget Sound Energy. You know, of course, Puget Sound Energy is not a public utility. That's my short presentation on Solar Washington, so the commissioner can entertain the idea of perhaps becoming a sponsor.
Yeah, Matthias, a question. I see that Clark and Snohomish are sponsors for this. How many smaller utilities, you know, those are located in mainly urban areas. How many smaller
Those are the public power utilities that sponsor.
They're the only
There's
ones.
There's no smaller. Yep.
They're the only ones that belong.
Yep.
Okay.
Understood.
Folks, I attended the summit last fall, and I thought it was very informative and educational in terms of the technical presentations and so forth. I also learned a lot about their role and their efforts to work with the Washington State Legislature on certain bills and so forth. And they were very informative about, you know, what some of these bills composed, what some of the pitfalls were and so forth like that. So I think it gave a good juxtaposition from the solar industry versus what we might hear from Waputa say on legislative issues revolving around solar. And you remember at the last meeting, I guess last week, you know, there was some kickback from some of the PUDs that we were coming across too negative on solar. And George mentioned, yeah, okay, we need to be a little bit more open-minded and unbiased in that regard. So I think adding them to our mix, they don't cost much money, and, you know, doing some participation in their summits and reading what they've got to say and so forth like that is worth it.
So, Matthias, do we have any idea how much staff time and so on would participation take in this organization? Do they? I looked at their website. They asked for technical support. They asked for, kind of an advisory thing. That would fall on you. So,
great. It's a little hard to say, you know, not having been a sponsor, you know, but I think, you know, at a minimum, I would suggest if we sponsor them that we go attend their solar summit, you know, which takes place over a couple of days in the fall. You know, other than that, my guess it would be maximum, you know, a few hours over the year. You know, I'm on their mailing list, you know, as I am with a number of different organizations just to see what they're doing, you know, and I generally read their information and look periodically on their website to take a look at, you know, bills that are going through the legislature that they're supporting and sponsoring, just to sort of have a general sense of what people in the industry are talking about.
Yeah, it probably overlaps with what you're doing already. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Other questions, discussion? I'm assuming that this next item, addition to organizational memberships, addresses this. Is that right, Sean?
Yeah, this was part of the board action items from last meeting, was to present the information on Solar Washington. And so if the commission would like to entertain membership, staff has a few recommendations on delegates and an alternate. One of them would obviously be Matthias. And the other one would be Colin Young in our engineering department. He has a degree in renewables. And so John Purvis thought he would make an excellent candidate as well. But we leave it to the board to make that decision if you'd like to join and who you would like the delegates to be.
Okay. Is that the next item, addition to organizational memberships?
Yes, correct.
Okay, good. Is there any other presentation that goes with that?
No, it's just looking for the okay from the board to A, join the organization, and B, accept Matthias and Colin as the delegates.
Okay. This is kind of a hot button item with a lot of people. I guess I would favor participating, but we need to keep track of how much effort is involved in doing this and, you know, what kind of a cost-benefit approach.
Well, granted, I guess, you know, like I've already said, I value their presentation, and like Matthias said, the main thing is the summit, which is maybe not even 2 days, because you get to pick and choose what subjects you want to participate in when you're doing it by Zoom. Anyway, so I would suggest that we go ahead and join them. And that's fine that they, the delegates are, that was suggested be the delegates, but I would certainly want to participate in the summit at least.
Hey, Rick, did you have any questions or comments?
I guess I'm a little indifferent about the issue. From my perspective, I'm, as long as the generation is acceptable to CETA, I'm okay with it. If it's solar, if it's wind, if it's wave generation, I'm indifferent. But to me, it's the price. At the end of the day, my goal is to keep our power rates as low as possible. So, you know, going out and getting, you know, additional information about solar is all fine and good. But at the end of the day, if the price is too high, you know, I'm not going to support it. So that's why I'm indifferent about whether we join. It seems like, you know, if people want to go to this summit, do they have to give this $350? And so, you know, are we giving $350 so that we can put that, you know, that logo on our website? You know, I'm indifferent. It's the price of the generation at the end of the day that's going to make my decision on how I vote.
Well, on that topic, going back to what Jim mentioned about the Wet'suwet'en discussion, There is a bill before the legislature to continue subsidizing solar. So there was a lengthy discussion about that. It's viewed as a mature industry, and so the question was asked, are subsidies necessary to continue? And actually, the group, WAPUTA ended up saying they would remain neutral on that legislation. So I guess that kind of brings up the topic. Would we be taking a position by in this organization versus a position in WAPUTA? So anyway, I guess I would favor trying this for a while, kind of on a conditional, and do an assessment at some later date. Does that sound acceptable or not?
Well, I guess you're saying, yeah, let's join them and try them out for a while. You know, Rick, your comment about the price, I agree with that. And all these discussions, you know, help us understand that. But we should be saying the same thing about hydropower. What is the price ultimately going to be? And we spend a lot of money getting briefings and presentations on hydropower, so I don't see this as any different. And the other renewables, whether it's batteries or wind or what up, I think we should be open-minded too, and I just don't know that for us, solar is probably the more realistic technology, solar and batteries, to be pushing or leaning, looking at and looking, you know, and so forth, just because of the conditions where we live and so forth.
But I guess the cost of solar power, even without the subsidies, firm solar power, and we need to make the differentiation between firm and intermittent, but the cost of solar is orders of magnitude higher than the hydropower, Jim, so I think you have to admit that, but...
Not according to the Public Power Council. I mean, not the Northwest Power and Conservation Council.
Well,
I mean, come on, you know, the...
We pay the bill. We pay the bills all the time, so we know what it costs. So anyway.
You know, you're trying to isolate solar by itself, and it has a great mix with a lot of things. And, you know, let's face it, rooftop solar is a viable option for a lot of people, and it takes, you know, it builds resiliency and so forth. But anyway, I don't know if we want to get in a full discussion about the pros and cons of solar versus hydro. I'd love to, but we probably ought to schedule something for that.
Okay. All right. Do you agree, Rick, that we join this on a conditional basis?
I would abstain.
Okay. Well,
that's enough to make it happen.
Okay. Well, let's try this out and monitor it very closely and see how much effort and cost there is associated with it.
Okay. So just for the minutes, I have approval to join and select Matthias and Colin as the delegates.
Yeah. You need a motion on that?
I just, if Will and Jim both agree to that, we'll log in the minutes.
Okay, good.
Will, might I suggest that you move your mic down just a little bit, because when you exhale, it makes a wind sound on our end.
Well, my heavy breathing has a message. Okay.
Well, you are coming across like a dragon, but that's okay.
Well, that's good. That's part of my persona. Okay, the next item is the BPA post 2028 contract discussion. I attended the WAPEG discussion myself. Did others get an opportunity to participate in that?
I was just going to note, Will, that John Purvis was going to make a presentation today for the post 2028 contract discussion, but unfortunately he had a medical event this weekend and is not here today and likely will be out this week. But Commissioner Waddell reached out to me and asked for some information on the Tier 1 system size analysis. And John was also going to piggyback on that as well. But Tyler is here, and he can answer some questions on that one presentation, Jim, if you'd like him to.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't make the WAPAG presentation, but I looked at the slides, and so I did have some questions on a couple of them, but I don't have the slides in front of me. That might be a little tricky, but
we can postpone until John's back and he can give his presentation.
Well, why don't we do that? I think okay. There's an interesting some points I think in that presentation that we ought to discuss, but I missed the presentation.
Well, I can kind of cue this up. Rick, did you attend? Did you?
Yeah, I attended. I didn't have any questions or.
Well, I think it's just important to talk about what the discussion was. It was all about allocation. And at present, it appears that there's leaning towards a revised tiered rate structure. And that's, again, we don't have the details of that yet. The other item that was discussed was talking about the contract high water mark. And a number of options were put forward. I won't go into all of them. But the tiered rate methodology seems to be something that's going to be part of the upcoming contract. I won't go into the algebra of this, whether or not the what is allocated to each utility. There is an equation for that. The tiered rate methodology was based on 2010 loads, and so the discussion was whether or not that needs to be revised, which it certainly sounds like it should be. And what else was talked about?
Well, it was also noted, or at least I came across, that the current high water mark hurts our PUD more than the other PUDs. Seems like almost out of the box, we're into tier two.
Yeah, we're very close, yeah.
So, a new methodology on the high water mark might help us, but I'm not sure we can get there.
It was kind of interesting to me that Ron was constantly asking for input from people on the virtual meeting, and he didn't get a lot. So are we doing enough as far as inputting that process? And it needs to be in line with our policies, not just a personal opinion. But I guess I just pose the question, are we doing enough input on that in those meetings?
What I find difficult is we typically have these meetings with Bonneville before we have talked about it as a commission, and therefore all you can do is give your personal opinion. You can't say, the PUD feels this way, and I'm not sure how we get out in front of that. Because some of these things I wouldn't have thought of until I was in the meeting.
Yeah.
So it's almost a catch-22, it feels like, to me.
Well, maybe, it's kind of a brain trust type thing. So maybe you need to preface any comments as your opinion rather than our utility's position.
Well, that's what I do. But it has less weight if you're giving your personal opinion rather than the opinion of the PUD.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, well,
it's a lot of weight anyway. It diminishes it even more if it's just your personal opinion.
That's true. That's right. Okay, any other comments on post 2028 contract?
Well,
like we've talked about, it's all kind of premature because we don't really. It's all in nebulous and in formation right now.
Well, here's something I thought was interesting that I got out of clearing up. PNGC Power releases an RFP. On the 18th of January, PNGC issued an all-source request for proposals for generating resources. The co-op is soliciting resources that can augment or replace the power portfolio beginning in 2028 when the new contracts begin. Robert Gray, who's the president, said that the RFP was released now because the long-term dynamics of the wholesale energy markets are changing, and the region's investor-owned utilities are all on the hunt for resources. We want to move early because we think it's a prudent move. What worries me is the reality that Bonneville just doesn't have enough resources to serve the public power today, and the wholesale market is getting tighter and tighter. If we wait until 2025 for BPA contracts, we may not have adequate time to respond. I thought that was really interesting, and for those that don't know, PNGC is made up of 15, I think, co-ops in the Pacific Northwest. Most of them are all full requirements customers. But I think it's important to know that even as a full requirements, I don't know if they call it a full requirements customer now, but you can still bring in a resource to sit on underneath what Bonneville provides on top. And we certainly have the opportunity to do that. And there are things that we need to start thinking about if we are going to explore. For example, we would need to get an enabling agreement. What's an enabling agreement? It basically provides the terms and conditions under which you do business with. In other words, if you're going to go out and buy 25 megawatts of energy, heavy load, light load, or flat, you have to have terms and conditions under which you're doing business with the other partner. Typically, what is used in the West is called the WSPP contract. It's called the Western States Power Pool. And it is typically the enabling agreement that all the utilities use when they buy power from one another or from marketers. I think that it might be prudent to ask staff to look into the WSPP or some other type of enabling agreement and to come back with a recommendation as to whether we want to join, because I believe it doesn't cost anything. But as Jim points out, you know, if we're going to start thinking seriously about some other type of resource that we could bring in as a dedicated resource, to our 2028 contract, we need to start thinking about some of the things, dotting the I's and crossing the T's, so that if we do want to purchase something, we're not coming in like some hillbilly that doesn't know how to spell, you know, or have any idea how the market works. We need to have an enabling agreement, and that might be a good place to start.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Can we look at that and maybe in the future get a staff presentation on it?
Yeah, you bet. No problem.
Okay, good. Thank
you. And if you have any questions about that, Sean, on who you might want to talk to, just give me a holler and I can point you probably in the right direction.
Sounds good, Rick. Thanks.
Will, I participated in BPA's financial workshop on the 12th. Most of the discussion had to do with asset management, and BPA's Bill Leedy gave a pretty overkill briefing of all their asset management, but it was a lot of process discussion, but it was still pretty insightful. One of the points that was finally brought out is that what are your asset classes and how do you group things? And then, you know, they're using the ISO 14000 standard, I believe it is, which is, you know, thousands and thousands of assets. But it seemed like they were getting to the point where, yes, we're not there yet, but we're going to be able to do asset management by dam. And that one of the things, of course, the asset management strategy is designed to do is decide whether you fix something, you repair it, or you retire it. And so ultimately, asset retirement is an option, and that, you know, your choice is basically retirement or run to red line to failure. And that we're talking about turbines here. And that is more or less the approach that BPA has taken on some of the core projects already. So without an asset management program, but at least now this program will help prioritize and put a real relative value, whether it's a turbine on this dam or that dam that needs to be spent. So I thought that, asset management is just real, and they've been at it for 4 years, and they're kind of like got two more years before it's fully implementable. Let's see. That I've been to some other meetings, but that was the only one that was really focused on 2028.
Okay. Sounds like we're getting into commissioner reports here, but all right, let's move on to correspondence communication. I believe there's an item there, airport water request article. I read that article in the paper. So, Tom, do you have that one?
Yes, I do.
Oh, good.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I saw the Scrim Gazette news article today for the first time, and we have been working on this airport water issue for several years now. This is something that the county, Clallam County, is aware of too. The Board of Clallam County Commissioners did send us a letter back in on November 15th is when we received it. That was the same date that we had the disaster out in Clallam Bay with the landslides and stuff. So we really haven't been able to get back to them. But this article, actually, it's good timing because I was going to talk about Carlsberg water rights. And this is a important part. The airport is an important part of the whole big picture for Carlsberg. There's Mr. Andy Salee approached me at the water department about 2019 sometime and was looking for ways to get water out there from the PUD so he could build out the airport. And he listed a lot of good reasons why that airport is important to our community. And actually, after living through the disaster out there in Clallam Bay and CQ and seeing how the DART program worked with volunteer pilots flying out to CQ Airport with water, you know, I completely understand why this is an important resource for our community. But there's the issue of getting water out there and service area expansion policy is that if we're going to expand our retail service area for water supply, we need water rights to do that first. And there's a lot of history behind that, and I'll go over that later on in this meeting when I talk about Carlsberg water rights. But, the way we left it with Mr. Salee, the last communication we had with him was in June of last year, so about 6 months ago. And, they're requesting fire flow and municipal or, commercial residential water supplies. So if we're going to do commercial residential, we need new water rights. But if they just want fire flow, we offered that as an option that maybe we could do that without getting new water rights because we have extended fire lines to some businesses outside or adjacent to our LUDs before in Carlsberg. So we could do it again, but this is going to be on a much larger scale. The county fire marshal sets the fire flow requirements. And back in June, he said that 3,000 gallons per minute for 1 hour is required. That's a lot of flow for any of our water systems here in Clallam County, the PUD water systems. So that comes out to be 180,000 gallons of water and fire flow storage. We only have 144,000 right now, and it's based on the largest building that we have.
Excuse me, Tom, but is that due to having aviation fuel and things on site? Is that?
Well, that's a question that the county fire marshal would have to answer. I think it mostly has to do with building construction type and how big it is. And possibly, the flammability of the material stored there. But I don't know the details. I'm sorry. I can find out for you. But you know, the largest fire flow we have now is based on our central warehouse facility. And that's, you know, a figure that's given to us by the Fire District 3 chief. And so we would have to build a lot more storage. And also there would have to be a dedicated 8 to 12 inch fire line going out to the airport from Carlsberg Road. And that's about 1500 feet. So there's a lot of money involved in building this out and a lot of engineering too, because you can trade off, you have to have a certain amount of water pressure out there to fight fires, 20 PSI. And so you can trade off with pipeline size versus storage, which would be built on the airport. And there may be FAA specifications that say, you know, how tall a structure you can build out there. There's lots of things that go into this. And we suggested that to Mr. Salih that he hire a consulting engineer to do an evaluation of how much water they want or need and what their capital facilities what are required and how much that's going to cost. So we haven't heard back from them since that, with that information, and since last February, about a year ago. And so we've gotten various kind of plans for how they're going to build out the airport. And some of it just includes a couple hangars, and some of it includes a more significant development. If I could share my screen, T, and I can show you.
You should be able to share your screen, Tom.
Okay. Can everybody see that?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is a drawing that the owners of the airport had an engineer develop for them, and you can see that it's more than just a couple hangars along the airstrip. They've got a lot more, looks like commercial and residential structures out there planned. So that could be a significant amount of water just besides fire flow that they're looking for. And so there's a long way to go on planning and developing this water system for the airport.
So all those little pink boxes or residences, they're going to make this like a fly-in community or?
And businesses, residences and businesses. And there are several houses around there also in the vicinity and neighborhood that might be interested in getting into this. So this is kind of looking like an LUD formation.
Do they have any water rights?
That's what they don't have. And we don't have them either.
It always comes back to water rights.
I'm afraid so. And, you know, I mentioned to the folks at the county that, you know, we have a water right application for the expansion of into the entire existing UGA, much less going out, you know, they're talking about forming a UGA out here for the airport. So we need more water for that. So I asked, would they be willing to take some of the water that we're asking for in our current water right application and use that for the airport instead of the full UGA? And there was, well, no, they want this existing water right application to just serve the existing UGA. So we have to have some discussions with the county too on this. And in the letter that the commissioners and the county sent to us back in November, you know, they didn't really acknowledge that they're a big part of getting the water for the PUD out in Carlsberg. So we need to partner with them to make this really happen.
But Tom, even after your very enlightening presentation last week, I don't. I have a very simple question. Is so they own the land there. Can they put a well in?
They can, and they have to get a water right. Pardon?
Or could we put a well in there? Is there any water underneath the ground there?
I believe that there is. In general, the closer you get to the strait, the deeper the aquifer, the thicker the aquifer is, and the more water there's available.
But this is in Wire 18, isn't it, Tom?
Correct.
So they would have to offset that with mitigation of some type. So.
Exactly.
Oh. So what'd you say that was in, Will?
He said it was WIRA 18, Water Resource Inventory Area 18. That's subject to the in-stream flow rule.
Talking here and I'm muted. it's the Dungeness River watershed.
So if they put a well in, I think what you're saying is they would have to replace the water back into that reservoir or that aquifer?
They would have to find a way to mitigate the new water use because that would have an impact on the streams in the river. And
but I mean, isn't that really? We don't have water service out there now. So that's really up to them to figure out if they want to put a well in, and then they've come to us wanting us to put a line out there, but it seems to me like the county has to make some changes before we could do that.
Yes, they do. They have to form a UGA, for one thing, in order to get sewer out there. We don't need a UGA to bring water out there, but that's where all the growth happens, and we're, per the Growth Management Act, we're supposed to provide water service in the growth areas. So,
is this another case where the college is going to say that, well, you can use some of that water that you have banked for build out of the LUD? Is this what we're facing, or?
Well, this is not in the existing UGA, and we have our existing water rights are dedicated to the LUD, and the LUD doesn't have, our water rights for that doesn't have enough for full build of the LUD.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
there's also a second aspect of this that, listening to Tom and, it makes perfect sense to me, the decisions that we've made given the water rights issues. But that article, at least from my perspective, it didn't shed a very good light on the PUD. And I'm not sure how we should respond, but it sounds like it's not really, the ball's not in our court if, decisions have to be made elsewhere for us to be able to help out. And somehow I think we need to get that message out.
Yes. And, we just also asked them to provide us with, well, how much water do you need? What are you going to build out there? And businesses, homes, airports, fueling stations, what is it? How much water do you need? And they have not gotten back to us. So I'm kind of disappointed in the sense of what you just talked about, that it doesn't really give PUD any acknowledgement of the work that we've done and how we've tried to partner with the owners.
Oh, I think Rick's got a great point. On all issues, power, water, all of our utilities. Over my tenure here at the PUD, I've seen our local control erode and erode and erode through legislation and state agencies, regulatory agencies. That message doesn't seem to have gotten out there to the public that we are limited in what we can do by those requirements that we have to live under. So I agree, we need to get our story out there a little bit more.
So that might be some type of an action item. I'm not sure exactly how to word it, Sean.
I can work with Nicole and strategize on something.
So I guess basically maybe just, not really a rebuttal, but our side of the story with respect to what was in the newspaper.
Okay, Tom, did you have more on that?
No, I don't.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Good job, Tom.
Yeah, good job.
I had one thing on the correspondence communications, Will.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
As you commissioners know, we have been working on our bond defeasance for the 2014 bonds, and we processed the defeasance at the beginning of this year. And on Wednesday of this week, we went into, or last week, we went into the market for the new bonds. And after some negotiating by our underwriter, we ended up with an aggregate debt service reduction savings of $1.9 million with a net present value savings of about $1.4 million. So we did a very good job. And we're very successful with our new issue.
That means everything, isn't it?
It is. Right. Just want to let you guys know that some big numbers there, that not too bad of savings on about $10 million.
Well, great. That's music to our ears.
we can afford to join the Solar Association.
Some good news.
Good job, Sean.
Okay. Sean, is that all you had?
That's it, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay, moving on to commissioner reports. Jim, you sound like you've got a lot to talk about. Why don't you go ahead?
Well, no, not really. The other meetings I attended were the WAPUTA meetings, and I'll report on the Education Committee because neither of you guys were there, but I'll let you two delegates to the other committees talk about what went on there. The Education Committee basically had a panel, and, well, of course, Will, you were on it, to talk about how hiring strategies and so forth, and I thought that was a pretty good job, and I thought you did a pretty good job laying out what we did here, and I think it came across pretty well. So that's let's see.
Well, thanks, Jim. I appreciate that.
You bet. Yeah. So that's all I really – it's worth repeating – that I did since the last meeting.
Rick, you want to go ahead?
Sure. On the 12th, I was at the WAPUTA Energy meeting, and as Jim said, they talked about, I think Jim mentioned that, they talked about the succession planning discussion. I thought, Jim said, I think Will did a really good job there representing the PUD. The other part of the discussion I found really interesting was they talked about rate increases for the different utilities that belong to WAPUTA. And I bring this up because I noted that Clark County reported that they haven't had a rate increase, I think they said, for 8 or 10 years. I thought that was really interesting, especially since they've come head in hand asking, you know, public or asking Bonneville to let them back on since their River Road. The reason they haven't had a rate increase for the last 8 to 10 years is no longer going to be viable for them. There was a little sense of irony there, I thought. There was on the 13th the legislative update, and man, I must admit my eyes glazed over after a while of hearing about all these potential bills out there. But there was one that really jumped out at me, and that was 5803, and it's characterized as the wildfire bill. But this is the one that if there's a wildfire, it's presumed to be caused by the electric utility if any power lines are anywhere in the vicinity of the fire. Presumed. I'm not sure what people are thinking there, but if something like that were to pass, electric utilities would be potentially on the hook for a lot of money. And I think what would end up happening, and I think we're starting to see some of this from PG&E already, is that utilities would become very, very risk averse. And what that means is anytime that the winds kick up, utilities would have to shut the power down because otherwise you may end up being liable for a wildfire. And, you know, I'm not sure people are thinking through some of these bills and whether this one really has a, you know, a hope in getting passed, I don't know.
On that, Rick, I just was going to comment the being risk adverse part. Our insurance carrier might mandate that to have insurance that we have to cut power when the wind hits a certain speed.
Yeah. And can you imagine if something like this passed, how much more risk averse they would become?
Right. Yeah.
Like I said, I have no idea when they report on these things whether these bills are really viable or not, but I almost fell out of my chair when I heard them describe that one.
Well, aren't they doing that in California already?
Well, like I said, PG&E now.
Yeah, I mean, they PG&E ended up with a $20 billion liability and more or less drove them into bankruptcy. So.
Exactly. I also heard that they've come out of bankruptcy, though, recently, haven't they? Thought that's what I'd heard.
Yeah, I think they've got an approved plan, so.
But see, the other thing I heard was arrearages. $270 million is what I wrote down, is what I had heard, how much arrearages there are for electricity and water. Let's see. That's all I've got on that, but I'm not sure whether this is the appropriate place to mention this, but I think we're all aware of Ted Simpson's loss, and I'm really sorry to have heard that. And Ted is such a gentle person and has contributed so much to this PUD. Let's be sure to remember in our thoughts and prayers, and let's make sure we send some flowers, Sean. That's all I've got, Will.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll second what you said about Ted. I knew Bobby for years, and she was quite a lady and an advocate for Ted, the PUD, and public power. So that's a regrettable loss. Okay, well, I also attended the WAPUTA meeting. I got too invested and attended all the committees, or most of them, except education. There was lengthy discussion about the legislation, kind of interesting. They've got a short session, and already there's 1,200 bills before the legislature. And most of them deal with their topics of renewable energy, equity, and things of that nature. Some are just a sampling. Sorry, how far this to me, this is kind of over the top, but there is a bill for electrification of landscaping equipment, including lawnmowers, snowblowers, weed eaters, and any other thing, pressure washers and so on. And part of that bill would require the state to do a buyback of gasoline-powered appliances. Don't know how far that'll go, but that's kind of the kind of shows you the logic of some of the things we're seeing. There was a lengthy discussion about a bill that would require utilities to help finance fuel shifting in buildings. And part of that would be that the benefits to the utility would have to be reported, and it'd be a lengthy reporting process. And one of the items that they put down was the improvement of indoor air quality. And that's not a responsibility of the utility. That's so the constitutionality of that bill was being questioned. Let's see what else. We talked about, in the Energy Committee, we talked about the CETA reporting and the Clean Energy Implementation Plan that's going forward. Most of the bills were based on Governor Inslee's wishes for, and it was all mainly centered around climate change. Let's see what else. They also talked about a low-carbon fuel standard, which would, of course, affect gasoline, diesel, natural gas, of course, and propane. Now, that's kind of problematic, I would think, in a rural county such as ours. There's a lot of people that use propane. So it'll be interesting to see where that comes about. As I said, the governor put out his climate agenda, and most of these bills are kind of based on that. Also talked about the solar deal and continuing subsidization of subsidiaries, supporting solar by subsidies, and that ended up with a lengthy discussion, which we've already pretty well talked about. That the arrearage item, $270 million, was certainly hope that passes. Not sure that's going to actually address the whole issue, but we'll see how that turns out. There was an interesting bill. This was put forward by Tim Sheldon, requiring the Department of Commerce and the implementation of CETA do an assessment of the impact on reliability and resource adequacy. So I think that's probably a wise thing to do, given the Texas and California experiences that we all know about. On that building, the electrification of buildings, they're talking about energy reductions of 30% going to 70% and in time going to zero. That's I'm not even sure that's achievable, but it's being talked about.
Well, it'd have to be if they'll make it a law, Will.
Well, that's right. I mean, the technology should just pop out of the ground and immediately. Okay. Well, the only way you could do that would be that you would have to generate your electricity, and of course, rooftop solar would address some of that, but it wouldn't address all of it. And given that it is intermittent, you'd still have to supplement it and firm it up. So we'll see how that turns out. There was some discussion about battery research and development. There is legislation for that, which is probably a good thing. But WAPUTA, the membership, is looking at a position on that. Let's see what else we got. You've already talked about that assuming responsibility of wildfires by utilities, and that's going to be an interesting one as we go forward. Okay, then going on to the board of directors meeting, there was a discussion of the legislative rally where they take people back to Washington, D.C. and talk to our representative staff as well as the representatives themselves. At the top of the list was an item, support for the Snake River Dams. Now, I got calls later that Commissioner Wardell made a comment that he didn't agree with that and so on. You know, it's the PUD's policy passed by resolution to support the dams. It doesn't have a lot of impact on this utility, but we're in line with other PUDs. So I think we're kind of sending a mixed message there. So if you want to take a position that's counter to the PUD's policies, then you should say that it's your personal opinion and not the position of the utility.
I'm pretty sure I did, Will.
Oh, did you really? I didn't catch that. Well, I got calls from a few people because they were a little confused, but okay, good. All right, I'll move on to something else. We've talked about the WAPAG thing. I think we've exhausted that. We also had a meeting of our Resource Adequacy Task Force at Energy Northwest. As I've said before, we've been working with Grant PUD. They're interested in a small modular reactor development. There's two vendors. There's X Energy, which is new technology. It's high temperature gas cooled what we used to call a gumball reactor, where the fuel is encased in graphite and ceramic, so that it's pretty safe fuel. Now, the downside of that is that technology requires a higher enrichment of that fuel than normally is used, like at Columbia and PWRs and BWRs. The only supplier of that highly enriched fuel is a Russian company. So that is problematic. So we'll have to get a waiver to use that fuel if that's the successful technology. Also, the Department of Energy is trying to develop that technology within the U.S., but it's going to be at Oak Ridge, and it's going to be, the timeline hasn't really been decided. Another issue with Grant is that we have a Site 1, which is one of those uncompleted dead nukes, which is right next door to Columbia Generating Station. It's already licensed for nuclear activity. That part of it would be pretty easy. The downside is that there would have to be transmission back to satisfy the loads in Grant County. So anyway, there's a meeting this week of the Grant Commission, and they're going to decide which location, or that's on their agenda to decide which location they'll go with. The other problem with being on Hanford, which is a kind of the logical place to put any nuclear activity, is that the tribes, there's a unified effort by a number of the tribes. They say that Hanford was a traditional gathering place for tribes, and they don't want to see any additional nuclear activity there until perhaps that can revert back to that usage. Now, I'm not going to make any negative statements about that, but the amount of nuclear activity on Hanford is not going to go away for probably a century, so it's kind of a moot point. But Grant is kind of invested in that, and they want to keep the tribes happy. So it's kind of looking like they're going to go back to the Grant now for location of this SMR. And, of course, the other thing is that you've got a high-value resource, and they want the economic benefits of having that in their county. And so we'll see how it goes, but that's the issue right now. Ruby Flats, that's the new solar project that's going in. It's 127 to 150 megawatts. It's constrained to 127 at this point, but 150 is possible. That is underway, and they're actually looking at power sales contracts for that power being generated. There's also an effort to firm up that power. Since it is intermittent, there's not batteries proposed for that large load or large generating facility. So they're talking to Shell Energy, and I have nothing to do with that. I want to know, let you know. But since I retired from Shell, and they're also talking to TEA for proposals on firming up that power. Some discussion of CAISO, membership in CAISO. It appears that we're kind of moving in that direction since we're already in the EIM market. There's a forum being put together by CAISO, led by Elliot Mazur, to on talking about integrating renewables. And that's going to be, they're also going to do a straw poll, this is CAISO, on April the 15th for a poll of the Northwest utilities. And talk about membership in CAISO and firming up and integrating renewables. Let's see what else. Talk about demand side management. There's a pilot program between Energy Northwest and the City of Richland going on right now. And also a little bit on aggregation services. Energy Northwest is working with three utilities to bring something together on a proposal to aggregate. Those utilities don't want their names to be published, so I won't do that. Just another little item here. I was reading in the PUTA publication that we have received or in the process of receiving a grant for $20.27 million for broadband infrastructure. I don't think those contracts have been finalized yet, but I would ask that we have a presentation to the commission to talk about what projects we would propose going forward and how do we spend that $20.27 million. So, and that's all I have. Questions, comments? Am I too long-winded?
Well, Will, since you said you went to all the WAPUTA meetings except the education meeting, I'm really curious. Did you have an avatar give your panel presentation on hiring?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was in that panel discussion. That's right. I thought that was received pretty well. We were kind of an outlier in that.
Yeah.
The most of these utilities were hiring recruiting services and we're going through a lengthy, they're actually looking at people all over the country, which we talked about doing, but since we had some very qualified internal candidates, we didn't go that route. But so, well, anyway, always sign up for a panel discussion. Okay, if we're through with that, let's move on to staff reports. The first one is the CQ office restructuring. Ruth and Cantor, you have those?
Yes. Good afternoon, commissioners. So CQ's full-time CSR, Connie Rubel, is retiring March 15th, and the district saw that as an opportunity to evaluate the in-person activity at the office and come up with a strategy to both utilize existing CSRs and maintain an in-person experience for the Bay Area folks. And with that, I'll turn it over to Shanda, and she can go over the details of that plan.
Hello, everybody. Good to see you. I can't wait for this to be in person one of these days. Here, I'm going to share my screen with you. I have a short PowerPoint just to go over the plan that we have for the CQ office. Okay, let me know if you can see it.
Yes.
You can see my fishing bowl? There we go. Okay.
Yeah, we see it. You've got something.
Yes, I have. Okay, so out in CQ, as you know, we have a business office for that area of community. And currently, these are the options that our Western customers have to take care of their Clallam PUD business and payments. In Forks, we have an office with a drop box and a drive-through window that is the lobby's currently closed like the other offices, but we're running the drive-through and drop box there. Out in Nia Bay, which is still closed to the general public, we have a payment kiosk, which we very recently, about a week ago, moved from the Macaw Education Tech Center to the Nia Bay Public Safety Lobby. And why did we move that? Well, it was brought up when one of many of Sean Delplane's trips out there that the existing place we had the kiosk prior was the internet was going out pretty often, and it was just not a super secure connection. Where its new location is open 24 hours, nights, weekends, holidays, a very solid internet connection, well-regulated power with generator backup. It's their police department, and it's staffed 24 hours a day. And then out in CQ, we have our office with a drop box and a payment kiosk already installed right there by the drive-through window. So, in CQ right now, here is our current staffing. We have one full-time customer service rep, Connie. After our previous long-term CSR, a couple of you might remember Billy, when she retired, we found it kind of challenging to recruit, train, and retain customer service reps local to this area's office. So at that time, this is when Connie began driving from Forks to staff the CQ office. She's there Monday through Friday. Weekdays, 8:30 a.m. to 3 o'clock p.m. She's closed for a half an hour for lunch. And Connie is retiring on March 15th, or in 50 days, she would say to you excitedly today. Upon her announcement of retirement, a couple months ago, she's been working on her notification to us for quite a while. So over this time, we've been evaluating this particular office for business and staffing going forward. So right now in our Forks area office, we have two full-time customer service reps, Renee and Caitlin, and we have one part-time customer service rep out there, Rebecca. This office is opened, like the main office, Monday through Friday, 7:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Now, with the distance between all of these communities, we do feel that some staff presence with office and kiosk maintenance is necessary for CQ. And just briefly, here is a area map listing some distance to the offices. As you can see, a Nia Bay customer is a good 50 miles to Forks, and CQ is 32 miles to Forks. So it's out there just a little bit. So it's been really nice to have the payment kiosks out there for the customers to make payments and all of our online resources for them to take care of a lot of their other business. So our plan for the office staffing out there going forward when Connie retires is we will be increasing the Forks staff from 2.5 to 3 full-time CSRs. We will keep the CQ office open on Fridays, rotating a Forks CSR out every week. This way the community can rely on consistent PUD personnel one day a week to do their business. And this is also necessary to ensure that we are servicing the kiosks properly. And we will also be removing the CQ office drop box so that payments aren't sitting in the box out there in between visits to this office. So we will receive payments by our kiosks as well as by phone, mail, our many online resources, as we have been through the entire pandemic. So that's the plan that we have here coming in a couple of months.
And have we received any feedback from local customers out there? Has this been rolled out to our customers?
This plan has not been rolled out to customers, but we plan on doing bill messaging and putting it on the website and using our social media resources to put it out there. This community, you know, as well as our other communities during this pandemic, has kind of adapted to doing most of their business online, over the phone, by mail. We've been pretty successful on reaching them and communicating with them without the lobby being open for quite some time.
Okay, thank you.
It seems like a reasonable plan to me, but what I would suggest, if the timeline works, is let's try to reach out to that community with this plan as being characterized as tentative until we can at least run it by as many of the folks out there as possible to see if Friday is the right day of the week. Maybe they would prefer a Monday or, you know, just that type of feedback so that we're showing that we respect their input.
Okay. I like that plan, Rick. I didn't mention this, but I do have had conversations with several of the members of the Macaw tribe that work for the tribe at the tech center, at the police department, and at the tribal center that does all the housing and agency assistance. I sent an email to them last week when I let them know that the kiosk moved, and I did mention this staffing change to them, and they are happy to work with the main office and the Forks office in the capacity that they need to, and they told me they would just spread the word, and they seemed completely okay with the plan, but I understand getting any more feedback, having some kind of community forum out there. I know they have some kind of community organizations and their visitor center, and they do a lot of business right through the cork board at the post office of all places. So we do have some options of getting the word out there. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it just try to be sensitive to their needs and,
yeah.
you know, or let them know what's going on and listen to their feedback.
Yeah.
Shanda, what kind of, prior to the pandemic, what kind of traffic people per day would visit the CQ office?
In my experience out there, and I've worked out there several days with that CSR, we would have anywhere from maybe 2 to 8. 8 would be a very heavy day. A lot of their foot travel is payments in the Dropbox and people just wanting to walk in on their way somewhere else. Their business has been able to be done through the drive-through and online pretty smoothly through the pandemic. Every time I go out there every weekend, actually, I live out there on the weekends, and every time I go by there, there's a truck sitting at the kiosk, and they're learning how to make payments using that. And we've not had any complaints about the connectivity to that.
Okay. Well, I guess, I agree with what, you know, your plan is and what Rick is suggesting to, you know, let people know and see what they might have to say about alternative days or something. But it looks like just in terms of traffic, it's hard to rationalize a 5-day full open office given that amount of traffic, and you could consolidate it down to a day or two, particularly given what the learning curve has caused people to go through during the pandemic.
I'll just add, too, that since the pandemic began is when we installed the exterior kiosk out there. And so customers can pay at the kiosk through any payment method that they so choose. And everything is posted in real time to their account. So rather than having the office only open 8 to 3 or 8:30 to 3, customers can utilize that 24 hours a day, which I think has been pretty successful since we installed that.
Well,
yeah, I go
I'm
back.
A little confused. I thought I heard Chanda say that they were removing the Dropbox.
There's a Dropbox and then there's a kiosk. And so a customer can just go through and then drop their payment stub into the Dropbox and somebody has to physically grab it. But at the kiosk, when they enter it posts to their account in real time. So we would eliminate the Dropbox just because it's not going to be manned 5 days a week. So their payment won't be sitting there. So, for example, if somebody's late, you want to make sure that their payment gets posted to their account immediately, and the kiosk achieves that objective.
And the kiosk, that they could pay with a check or?
Yep. Check, cash? Credit card, or cash. Yep.
Okay. Great.
Yeah, I agree with your plan, Shonda. I think it sounds good. I go back to period. The public seems to be very sensitive to these type changes. I know when we closed our Washington Avenue building and just rented a space a few blocks down the street, we had a lot of, well, that's too inconvenient. But anyway, so I think it's important we do kind of feel out the local population and see how they feel about it.
Okay.
Okay, so that's an action item. Are we done with that? Thank you very much, Shanda and Ruth.
Thank you.
Okay, before we move on, well, let's talk about action items. T, did we get, I think there were a couple of action items there.
Yes, there are three, Will. Staff is to look into the enabling agreement and present findings on that. And if and when the district becomes recipients of funding for broadband, staff is requested to present plans on how those funds would be utilized. And then the last item is what you just proposed, that we kind of move forward with the CQ changes as a tentative plan or a pilot plan and just kind of get some feedback on how that's going for the public out there and before making it permanent.
Okay, good. I, on another board, got pushback from the staff that the action items were not articulated quite well enough and whether or not they were coming from individuals in the board or the board as a whole. So does the board agree with those action items?
What I heard.
Okay. Jim, you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay, great. All right. Before we move on to our next, let's take, wait a minute. We've got the Colesburg Water Rights presentation. Before we do that, let's take a 5-minute break.
Oh, thank you. It was a little bumpy there with sharing screen, but I got it.
Are we still hearing my heavy breathing? I'll take that as a no.
Yeah, you're still there.
Okay, still breathing. Oh, well. Mm-hmm. Breathing is a good thing, Jim.
You asked for my input.
Okay, Rick is not back yet, but... There we go. Okay, we'll reconvene and move on to the Colesburg UGA Water Rights Part 2
Tom, is go ahead.
Thank you, Commissioners, and good afternoon again. T, can I share my screen here?
You should be fine. Go ahead and share, Tom.
And there we go. So I'm going to start off where we were left off last week, but at the end, I'm going to present what a consulting engineer gave me for a schedule to build this treatment system for the nitrates, to treat the nitrate water quality problem, and which involves using the new well that was drilled by the county and our existing LUD-10 well. So where we left off was there. Okay, so just to refresh your memory, I give you the history of nitrates over the years in our LUD-10 well, and as you can see here, the last one was near, getting close to 8. The maximum contaminant level is 10, and the way things are, the trend is going, 4 to 6 years, we're going to reach that. So we need to think ahead about getting a treatment system in place. And that involves blending, there we go, the new well, the existing well, with a blending tank right on Windy Way over by Ideal Place, and a dedicated transmission line that goes to, from both wells to that tank. We'll mix together, dilute the nitrates, and then pump that out into the distribution system. So,
Bob, can I ask a question here?
Yes.
The nitrates were supposedly coming from septic systems in that area. And I know that some people resisted connecting to the sewage system because they just invested a lot in septic tanks. Do we know, is that still an issue or is that gone away?
The county is the one managing the septic systems out there.
Yeah, I know that, but they have an inspection program and so.
Well, for a while there, they were allowing these mound system or pumped system, recirculating systems that supposedly treat nitrates. We have a couple of them in our own systems in the PUD. And in a place like Carlsberg, where there's the soils are just so highly drained that even those systems, I'm very skeptical that they work very efficiently. So the soils under the drain field essentially are part of the drain of the treatment system. And when that part goes away in Carlsberg, we end up with this nitrate problem.
And there was also some debate over whether agricultural activity was contributing to that too. So anyway,
yes.
Just a comment.
Yeah. Well, the direction of groundwater flow is toward the strait. So any sources uphill to the south are a likely candidate to be the source of contamination in our LUD-10 well. Moving on here, there's a bunch of history here that I don't want to get into very deeply, but it is important, and I sent this in the PowerPoint slide to you in your packet. So, but I guess what's important for the LUD is if you look at the map, it shows the UGA and the LUD. The LUD is in the blue areas that's within the UGA. Those purple and purple areas are in the UGA, but outside of our LUDs. So they're outside of our service area. And we only have enough water rights to, we don't even have enough water rights for the build out of the blue areas. So we need more water to serve these purple areas. This yellow area here is part of our LUD, but it's outside of the UGA. It's along Atterbury Road, further to the west. So the UGA was formed in 2005. I don't know why the some parts were inside and some parts were outside of our LUD. It just may have been the landowners who were willing to sign up for the LUD back then. And this kind of ties into the airport, too. Why wasn't the airport included into the UGA back then? Who knows? But when I started in 2006, one of the first things that I did was put together a water right application so that we could get enough water to serve these purple areas, you know, to expand to cover the entire UGA. And that water right's been sitting there for a while. 2007, the county asked us to participate in a sewer facility study where we were planning on building a sewer treatment facility by the Central Operations Center there on Idea Place. And during that whole sewer study, we looked at, you know, we evaluated and estimated what the full build-out water needs are for this whole area. The sewer was based on something like 5,000 ERUs. And since then, the county has reduced the density that was recommended by the Carlsberg Citizen Advisory Committee. I still think that the motivation for the county to do that was to reduce the amount of water use in order to fit the amount of water rates that we had. It's kind of a backwards way to do things, but nevertheless, the zoning density has been reduced, and so has the water demand, and it's been recalculated several times over the years. So in 2013, the Dungeness in-stream flow rule was adopted. So all water right has to be, for new water has to be mitigated. And that includes, you know, expanding into the rest of the UGA for these purple areas. And so, mitigate first, you get your water right second. Well, the sewer facilities plan, came in, you know, during this whole rule adoption, and the Dungeness Water Exchange was created at that time, and so that they were setting the price for mitigation certificates for households, somewhere around $2,000. Well, in a sewer area, you have a lot more consumptive use. In a house out in the county with a septic system, only 10% of the water that goes into the house actually gets used and evaporated and removed from the watershed. 90% goes right back in. With a sewer area, it's 100%. All your water goes into the house, goes into the sewer, over to Squim now, and out into the Strait. That's 100% consumptive use. That's 10 times more. So what the Dungeness Water Exchange is saying that in order to get a mitigation certificate for a house inside the Carlsberg sewered area, it's going to cost 10 times as much. So instead of $2,000 for a mitigation certificate, it's going to be $20,000. And the price just went up in June of last year, so now it's going to be $40,000 for a mitigation certificate. That is not the avenue that is the least cost for mitigating new water in Carlsberg. So we had planned on reusing reclaimed water, and we had the city of Squim kind of involved in that because they would be reclaiming the water, and then the county would buy it, and then infiltrated into a ground, into a shallow aquifer to mitigate the impact on the streams. And so in 2016, the PUD led the effort to put together a three-party agreement with the city of Squim, Clallam County, and the PUD. And we looked at, a phased build out and mitigate kind of as you go along. And the other two parties, the county and the city, rejected that. And instead of looking at a long-term plan, our reaction here at the PUD was to pass the to formalize our already established policy that we would need water rights first before we can expand our retail service area. So in 2017, we adopted a formal resolution along those lines. So that's the LUD. The so there's the water rights here. I want to just show you back in 1990, the water right was, for the LUD 10 well had a place of use described as within the red circular area on the bottom of the left. That lists a whole bunch of sections within, township range section. They're square miles. There's 15 of them, which surround Carlsberg. That was the original intent. I don't know why they specified a 15 square mile that would be served by one well. There would be very expensive pipe that would have to run all over the place. And I think they had in mind what they did in Fairview for LUD1. But since the municipal water right, municipal water law was passed, and the place of use is now specified in your water system plan, and that gets updated every 6 years. So in the water system plan, it shows a change from this really large area to just the UGA and our service area at the UGA. So that was a big change. So in our 2006 water right application, back when I started, we said, okay, August 2006, municipal use, the place of withdrawal is right there in the business park loop, or maybe another place. We thought there could be another place besides the existing LUD 10 well. And we said, the place of use, these are the four P's of a water right here, the existing service area, and the entire, expanding out to the entire UGA. And the quantities, we asked for 215 acre feet per year with a maximum instantaneous withdrawal of 510 GPM. So since then, the county, we entered into an agreement with the county in 2013. That's when the county decided, well, we're not going to have a treatment plant built in that the PUD would run over an ideal place. Instead, they would pump the sewage over to Squim for treatment and reclamation. Well, we already had a plan for mitigation where we take the reclaimed water that we treat in Carlsberg and put it back in the ground in Carlsberg, so that we'd mitigate the impact as close as we could to a new well. And so now we have the treatment being over in Squim. And we said, okay, well, if you're going to do that, we're going to need another way to get water rights. And so the county agreed that they would take our public works board, a loan that the PUD received for $10 million. We assigned that to them so they could build a sewer. And in return, the county agreed to get us, procure us water rights through full build out of the existing urban growth area. So, it's since that agreement in March of 2013, the county has been setting the pace on getting the water rights. And so, now we're at 2022. It's been almost 9 years now, and we're still having running into obstacles trying to get the water right. And this is just the whole list of things. The most recent activity was about a year ago, where we, in March of 2021, where we submitted the mitigation plan. And that was, instead of using reclaimed water, we would take water that we normally take out in our existing LUD 10 well from a middle aquifer, which has a pretty high impact on stream flows, and we've shifted the production over to the new deep well down in aquifer 4, 900 feet deep, and that would be, much less impact on stream flow. So that was how we would mitigate the new water use. And so we gave that, we submitted that report, that draft plan to the Department of Ecology, and they had several problems with that. And basically they sent us, we met with them once in June last year. In August, they sent us a letter that said, you know, here are the reasons why we're rejecting your plan. In September, they gave us another email, said, oh, let's have a meeting. Instead, they just called, you know, they sent us another letter with more comments. So now they're requesting a very comprehensive regional water plan with the county. And so there has to be a lot of public involvement with that to show that we're meeting this public interest test for this new well. So, you know, I've actually asked the county to start a public process by redrawing or the retail service area map to include the entire UGA. And I asked the county DCD director to do that one thing so we can have a public process to show public interest, and they denied that request for whatever reason they had. So that is just delaying things even more. And I just don't have time to wait. We don't have time to wait for a new water rate to come from this new well because of the nitrate issue. And so we're moving out on another alternative, and I'll explain about that in a minute. But I think you need to understand a little bit how this mitigation works through the Dungeness Water Exchange and through the rule. It's all based on this Dungeness groundwater model, and this just shows kind of the area that it covers, and then it goes, it's a three-dimensional model, so you have different layers going vertically down. Each one is a different layer of aquifer, and there's aquifers 1, 2, and 3, shallow, middle, and deep in this model. And so they actually took all those model results and they boiled them down into a mitigation calculator, where all you have to do is plug in a parcel number and it'll tell you what the impact is on the shallow, middle, and deep aquifers. And these percentages here that are in this little table in that row, that represents the percent of water that you're pumping out of the well that actually comes from streams that you have to mitigate. So as you can see, there's a trend. From the shallow aquifer, there's 90% of what you pump comes from the streams. If you pump from the shallow aquifer, middle aquifer, the percentage goes down to about 75%. In the deep aquifer, there's 43%. So you can see there's an obvious downward trend in the impact as you go deeper. That's the basis of our mitigation plan. And the model shows that. Now they have this bedrock aquifer there that was not included in the model at all. That's aquifer number 4. And they note that they're saying that the percent impact is the same between the deep aquifer and the very deep aquifer, aquifer 4. Well, this is where we drilled into, 900 feet deep over there on the end of Carlsberg Road. And we're saying that the percent impact is a lot lower. If you follow this trend, it's more like 11% instead of the 43. And that makes a big difference. That tells you how much water you need to mitigate and how much money you got to put into mitigating. So, you know, we use this mitigation calculator to show what the impact is in the middle aquifer at the existing LUD-10 well, and then in the deep aquifer for the new well location. And if you follow the trend, like I was talking about in this graph, we're estimating about 11.7% impact. And from pumping from that very deep aquifer 4 well. And then that's kind of like the overall picture. Well, if you take that impact, the model also distributes what the impact is on each one of the streams in the rural area. So everything from Bagley Creek out on the west side of the rural area, all the way past the, you know, the Dungeness River and over to Bell Creek and Squim. And they say, okay, this is kind of what you're looking at in gallons per day impact. you have from each stream. And that's a, you know, pretty small impact, but, you know, it's a de minimis argument. It doesn't matter how small the impact is, you have to mitigate it. So when we're looking at the future use estimates for the build out, the county, when we're putting together the mitigation report with their new zoning, their new lower zoning, came up with 261 acre feet per year that we need in new water rights in order to meet the full build out of both our existing, the shortfall in our existing LED area and the expansion into the rest of those purple areas in the UGA with a 510 gallon per minute maximum instantaneous. So, so we originally requested 215 acre feet per year back in 2006 before we went through 10 years of sewer studies and rezoning and so forth. And in 2014 for the sewer plan, Ecology approved that plan with this build-out number in it. And, of course, well, the county came along and reduced that. But anyway, the sewer was built to a much larger flow and build-out capacity than the water system will be because of the reduced zoning. So, I would rather see the water system designed to the same specifications as the sewer, but it looks like we're going to reduce it anyhow because of the zoning change. The problem with that is zoning can be lowered, but it also can be increased in the future, and there's nothing that we can do now to restrict a future board of community of county commissioners to restrict that zoning in the future. So we're taking a little bit of risk there, but not much we can do about it. But Ecology has an issue is that we're not using our existing water right too fully right now. You know, I talked about water right perfection. That's when you put all your water right to beneficial use. Well, you know, we've got about 20% of our existing water right perfected now. The rest of it, the unused portion, is the QA inchoate water. And because of the municipal water law, there's no user to lose it. We're not subject to relinquishment. So we can grow into that amount. But we know that amount that we have in our existing water right, the inchoate water, is not enough for full build out. So what's the development schedule? How long is that going to take? Well, you know, it depends on the growth rates. But in any case, when we build out, we have to mitigate according to the new mitigation rules of the Dungeness in-stream flow rule. We have to mitigate in time, in place, and in kind. So in kind means water for water. And in place, when there's an impact on a stream, you got to put water back into that stream. And if there's if it happens at a specific time of year, we got to put water back in at that time of year. So our mitigation plan says, well, first we're going to, in our development schedule, first we're going to expand our service area using our existing water right. And then secondly, we're going to take that amount of water that we've expanded and shift the production from our existing well over to the new well. And that will provide mitigation in time, in place, and in kind. And so given the growth rates that we had in the sewer plan, we were looking at, well, today we're only 23% perfected. By 2055, we're looking at full build out.
Tom, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Sounds like you're having to deal with a lot of rejections and denials here, but is there any opportunity to use that the water that we're not using for customers to put like a pump and dump that would change this picture?
Well, We could, but we'd have to use our existing water right to do that.
Well, it sounds like that's the issue with ecology, that we're not using it, but if you were doing a pump and dump, you would be using it. Is that an overstatement?
Well, yeah, no, we'd be taking a chunk of our existing water right and using it for putting it into a stream.
But then would you have the opportunity to back away as you have build out and you require that water for other use? Could you back away from the pump and dump? Anyway, I'm just brainstorming here. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, that just takes away from the, you know, from the build out.
Well, no, I'm saying that if you're no longer needed to do the pump and dump, then you could take that water and use it for build out.
Oh, well, yeah. Sure.
I think, Will, it would come down to whether you were using that water as part of your mitigation plan or not. If you weren't using it as part of your mitigation plan, then maybe you could stop doing it and reallocate it to customers.
Well, it's all about in-stream flow.
Yes.
So, anyway, we can talk further later on that. Go ahead, Tom. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, we wouldn't have to dump any water into streams by simply going to pumping from a deeper aquifer. We're taking less out of the streams. So that's what we're doing instead.
But it sounds like they've already rejected that based on their model. Is that?
Well, I think they agree that we're going to be reducing the impact, but it's, you know, how much are we going to reduce it?
Yeah.
And because they're saying that aquifer 3 and aquifer 4 are the same, ecology is actually making a disincentive to drill deeper and reduce the impacts to streams.
Yeah.
And actually, we have talked about this, the county and I, to the Dungeness River Management Team folks, and the county has been talking to the tribe, and I think everybody's starting to get it, that ecology should be incentivizing deep drilling in order to reduce impacts on streams, and they're not. And so we're planning to go back with ecology, to ecology, not only just the county and the PUD, but also have all the other stakeholders in water managers in the Dungeness behind us on this, including the tribe. So anyway, this is our development schedule. The graph on the left, the upper line shows the growth in water use from 2037, which is, you know, 20 years out from the end of our planning horizon, in our last water system plan, and going out to full build out in 2055. So the plan is on this middle line, that is our existing LUD 10 well. We start using more and more of it as we expand, and then we transfer production to the new well, and it jumps up, and it uses more for a while. And then we, you know, expand some more with our LUD 10 well, and then we transfer production to the new well. So we do this in phases over in time, and we fully mitigate in place, in time, and kind. So in this graph over on the right, the dark blue line that starts high and goes low, that's the amount of inchoate water we have. We got a lot of inchoate, a lot of unused water right now, but by the 2055, we'll use it all. And in the meantime, the new well, we're going to be perfecting the existing water right, and the new well takes up, you know, the rest of it. So it's not like we're going to mitigate all at once. We're going to mitigate over time and shift production over time in order to mitigate as growth occurs.
Tom?
Yes.
Tom? Could you, back on that previous graph,
sure,
your forecast of water consumption,
mm-hmm,
can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
Can you base that on, is it just a linear progression from what's happened historically, or?
Well, the units there on the vertical axis are ERUs, that's equivalent residential units. So that's basically, you know, number of households. And, you know, businesses can use several ERUs, you know, up to you know, 20 or more for large businesses. So the growth rate is based on a compounding formula. And so the interest were essentially the growth rates were based on county or Office of Financial Management data that the county has available. But then, you know, that's historic data. And there wasn't water there for development. So that historic data doesn't really represent the future when you'll have water to develop. So the growth rates were assumed to be higher in the sewer facilities plan. And they were up more like 4 or 5% at some times. And so basically we use the growth projections from the sewer facility plan for this.
The reason I bring that up is that looks very similar to some projections that Bonneville had for power consumption back a number of years ago, and it was one of the big mistakes that Bonneville made in load forecasting, because they just, I think, did a 2 or 3% growth just, you know, linearly out through time, and, you know, it never manifested itself. And I'm not suggesting that that would be the case here, but one has to be really careful when you project consumption for the future.
Yeah, that was the genesis of whoops, wasn't it?
You're talking about? Yes.
You know, Rick, your comment is also consistent with what we've seen in terms of the business trends and in terms of load growth for electricity in the county. We're simply not seeing the kind of growth that you might expect, you know, like it happens around the country, because of our constrained system we're under right now, with BPA is basically our sole provider, and all the constraints that were talked about, you know, even by Colleen and others over the last year or two. So I guess this fits right in with that too. Are we looking at a trend line that's it's not probably realistic given the existing constraints we have on any kind of growth?
But when you're predicting the future, you're always going to be wrong. So.
Yeah. Tom, I didn't mean to beat you up about it. Forecasting the future is not an easy thing to do. And I would just give you a little caution that, you know, maybe the growth might not show up as we think it might.
Okay. So, yeah, it would push it out further than 2055, you know, let's say 2075. Nevertheless, ecology is very hesitant to approve any kind of growth beyond 20-year horizon. And but, you know, we applied for this water right in 2006. It, you know, in 4 more years, it'll be 20 years since we applied for that water right.
That doesn't feel right, does it?
And it's just going to get harder and more expensive to get water rights in the future. So
yeah.
We're asking for them now, and we're giving them this justification that you can see here on our development schedule. We can expand this out another 25 years, and they'll still say the same thing at ecology. You know, it's speculation. The alternative is to, you know, start relaxing our policy on our expansion, you know, water right first before expansion. And so.
Yeah, I don't think that makes sense.
No. Well, that's what ecology is pushing for. And so here's, you probably read all this. I can't get into it all, but, you know, that original intent is something of the original water rate is something that ecology sticks by. And we have that 15 square mile area that they want us to serve. But then the UGA came along and it's like, well, all the growth is supposed to happen in the UGA. Why are you asking us to serve this whole large area. And you have the Dungeness Water Exchange now, and they're essentially providing water service by issuing mitigation certificates now. But so that's why ecology is asking for a regional plan now. It's like, well, you were supposed to serve this whole area. You know, the PUD is being responsible for proliferation of exempt wells. And it's like, no, we're not. We're supposed to serve where the growth is happening. And by the way, who's going to pay for a main extension, you know, 10 miles away from our well, from the end of our distribution system? Nobody's going to pay for that.
Did I, maybe my memory is faulty, but I thought in exchange for expanding out and serving the old UGA, the county took on the responsibility of obtaining water rights for us. Is that?
That's correct.
Well, what's happening with that? Is that we seem like we're up to our backsides in this.
Well, what's happening is it's making, you know, ecology is making it more difficult for us. They're putting all these public interest arguments out there. Like,
but the county didn't. We didn't tell the county it was going to be easy. So
no, and nobody said it would be. Especially with water rights, you never know what they're going to come up with. And this public interest test, ecology can come up with anything. There's no standard for it across the state. So this is, the comments from ecology are just pretty clear that their position is that they're ready to go to court over this. And unless we get a lot of public interest demonstrated. And that's why, you know, we're working with all the other stakeholders. And, the county's starting to do that. But, the nitrates won't wait. The nitrates keep going up. So I come up with an alternative here. Instead of a new water right subject to all these requirements from ecology, the water right blending system will only be for our existing water right and for our existing service area. And so that, you know, we can address the water quality problems to our existing customers. So we don't need a water right that asks for more water. We just need a water right to ask for another place of withdrawal and not increase the amount that we're asking for. All we want to do is tap into another aquifer with clean water and blend the two sources together without going over our existing water right allocation. So I talked to our water right attorney for this. She said this is done frequently. This is not an uncommon practice. And because it's so-called water neutral, we're not asking for new water that needs to be mitigated. There's no public interest test, so we don't have to go through all this other rigmarole that for this new water right that we've been trying so hard to get for years. So it goes right to the front of the line for ecology processing. We don't have to wait for other water rights. There's a lot of advantages of going this route, and from being it timely and getting this blending system constructed in time, before the MCL is reached. So this is the schedule that I've went out for a request for qualifications for an engineering firm to go through this whole process and design the system. And, you know, it brings us out to the end of this year where it looks like we could go out to bid for building this. And a lot of this depends on, how long it takes for agencies to approve this. The Department of Health needs to approve this because we're adding a new treatment system. And plus, we're adding the Vanland water system, which is that, where the new well is located. There's 27 houses out there. We plan on operating that water system from the beginning and just tap into the new well and serve that. So So that opens up our whole water system plan for public process and public review. And hopefully that won't delay the schedule very much, but we'll see. So
is you've ran this up the flagpole, ecology is bought into this so far, or do we know?
No, we haven't run it past ecology yet, but that's one of the first things we're going to do is have the consulting engineer work with our water rights attorney, and we're going on the advice of our attorney that this is a common practice and ecology should have no problem with it.
So go ahead and end test and we'll start it again. Back to... Go ahead and mute yourself.
We got somebody that needs to mute.
It's been done, I think.
Okay. And then, so the airport, of course, fits into all this. You know, that's just another area outside of the UGA that we're being asked to serve too. So we need new water for that. And as you just seen, what I've just explained to you in the history here of what's going on in Carlsberg, this is just another request for new water and expansion of our service area. So it's not a very straightforward process, and it's not like we can just go and get federal infrastructure funds and build this thing.
Hello.
Somebody needs to mute. Tom, well, you're used to rejections and denials, but so drive on.
Well, yeah, that's it for my presentation. I'm over by 10 minutes.
That's fine. Any questions or comments for Tom?
Good job, Tom. I'm not sure I absorbed as much as I would like to, so I may have to come back and revisit it, and I may have questions for you in the future.
Yeah, that's just kind of sets us up for, you know, the rest of the project moving forward. I'll keep you informed as we go along, and feel free to ask any more questions. I know this is a lot of material to jam into a couple half-hour sessions, but thanks for your attention.
So I'm not saying we'd ever go there, but there has been litigation with ecology over their enforcement of water rights. How has that gone? Has there been successes there or not?
Well, yeah, litigation is possible. They have to
like
make,
I said, I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying.
Well, it's that public interest test, Commissioner, that is the wild card.
Yeah.
They can pull anything out of their hat for that. And, yeah.
Yeah, understood. Okay, no more of the comments or questions for Tom. Thank you, Tom. That was great. We'll have to have a refresh on that one later, but that was great. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, I don't think we had any additional action items there. Am I wrong?
No, you are not wrong, and it's time for the second public comment. So if anyone from the public would like to make a comment, please raise your hand or provide your name.
Got a question here from Jim.
Yeah, maybe an action item that I'm not sure how to handle, but these letters that we got from Forks, FEM, and PA on stakeholder meetings, two of them are outright requests for us to hold stakeholder meetings, so they deserve an answer. So I guess I guess we need an action item for the staff to propose some sort of an answer or something, or at least some discussion about how we might want to address this. These, you know, stakeholder ideas, input, or whatever we want to call it. But I think it needs some further discussion. I just don't know whether it's a real action item or something we just need to keep thinking about or working on or what.
Well, I think like we discussed, it's a little premature, but yeah, they deserve a response. Sean, is that a good action item?
I guess I would ask for a little bit more direction on that one, because are you looking for me to put together a plan to hold a stakeholder meeting, or I guess exactly what is the board looking for?
Well, to my mind, you just need to explain. They obviously don't have enough information of the process. They don't know how the process goes. So like we talked about, it's a little premature to hold public meetings on this topic when we don't even know what it looks like yet. So maybe
Bill,
inform them that.
You know, I think you've even admitted and that it now is the time to bring up these ideas to our association groups and stuff like that, or however we want to do it. And I think it to sit here and come up and wait 2 or 3 years to do something like this, it means nothing. It's not a public input process anymore because it's way too late by then. And so if we're going to do this, frankly, we need to be doing it this spring. And so that it has a real possibility of getting ideas and input into the process early on. Otherwise, it's no point. I mean, all we're going to be doing is explaining to them, oh, we've got a contract. It's just like a lot of other people's PUDs, and here's how it's going to impact you.
I guess my take on how the contract negotiations, at least from how I've understood it from Ryan, they have a small working group that are going to try to sort of nail down some of the hot topics, and then they're going to take those hot topics to the broader public power group and see if they can get compromise or some sort of consensus. And by compromise, I think they're looking for like 80%. So I'm not sure what, like Will said earlier, I'm not sure what, if we take something that one of our customers wants to the group, I'm not sure what kind of traction that will get.
Well, let me point out, though, it's not just the contract. It's what this PUD may want to do, like Rick brought up, instead of 100% load following or whatever with BPA. And I think that's what we, even as a PUD, regardless of whether somebody requests it or not, ought to be thinking about. Or what is our 20-year view of renewables, because that's what this period is covering. And so I think it's not just the contract itself, it's the future of energy development with this PUD and bringing in some stakeholders to talk about that. And so it's things that might parlay into some discussion with WAPEG about the contract, or it may be something we do on our own or part of our strategic plan or something like that.
I guess what I'm hearing, at some point you have to compare different options to a Bonneville load following contract or slice contract or whatever it takes. So we don't even know what that looks like. As I understand it, WAPEG is putting together a position paper with input from throughout public power. I'm not saying don't hold public meetings. I'm just saying that we need to have a better handle on what the whole thing looks like before we launch off into that. We can hold public meetings and get the preference from a subset of our customers, but I don't know.
The only only benefit I think that this could have is I would take it in a different direction. I think I would take it into explaining how the market works. You know, what does it take to participate in the market? And then looking at how would a utility like Clallam potentially get into the market? You know, what does that mean to get into the market? And at the end of the day, I think the only way that it could potentially make sense for us is if we joined a bigger buying group, be it, you know, I don't know what that would look like, but my expectation is that between now and 2025, there are going to be utilities that coalesce around wanting to work together in buying some type of resource to augment their BPA product. So if we were going to do something with our customers, I think the thing to do at this point would be more education. If we had a workshop that talked about, A, the Bonneville contract, B, how would you go out into the marketplace and potentially bring something in, and, you know, so it would be more of an education thing, and I'm not saying that we wouldn't listen to the input, but Jim, you have to know at the end of the day, it's going to come down to price for me. If it's CETA approved, then I'm going to be looking at what the bottom line is. And I'm going, you know, my drive is to keep rates as low as possible. And going out and buying solar at this point in time is just not financially viable. Now,
wait a minute.
Here's the penalty.
All right, that's where I am today, and I'm not changing. We're kind of getting into problem solving here. I think Rick's suggestion that we just educate the public a bit, and maybe we can put something together to do that. Contracts, the risk, reward of being in the market, what it would take to contract with the aggregator, all of those options. We can talk about this stuff from an educational point of view without actually, you know, putting forth, asking for decisions.
Well, okay, I agree with, you know, everything Rick said, but I think you have to point out that everything from somebody putting a solar panel or buying a battery all the way up to a full-blown, we sign 100% of our power like we have with Bonneville Power in that educational window. You know, that's all I'm saying is that let's be open-minded about what we're talking about and educating folks on how it is that we get the lowest reasonable price for electricity through all these different mechanisms, as in that, let that help shape our view of how we march forward, whether it's part of a BPA contract or not.
I don't see how it couldn't be a BPA contract.
A slice or a block or something, but BPA is going to have a piece of it for sure. Sean, do you have something to work with there?
I'm not sure.
Just say yes.
I guess is this something that you would like a special meeting where we invite the individual organizations who sent us letters and we hold an education forum? I'm a little bit.
I think what we're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that we need to respond to those letters.
Okay.
And so maybe
I can draft a response
and
that we
just
can mail
say
to them.
That we will put on public meetings for educational purposes in the near future after this thing gels a bit.
Okay, I'll make sure that for the next meeting I have a draft letter in the board packet for your review.
Okay, and we can wordsmith it from there. That sounds good.
Fair enough.
Okay.
You have a hand up there.
Yeah, I know, but we're not to public comments yet. Okay, no more action. Well, we got another action item. T, did you capture that one?
I did, Will, but I think I'm.
Yeah, talk to Sean. I think he's got a good handle on it.
I've got several versions of it. I think we're going to have to, you know.
I understand what we need to do, T.
Okay,
good. All right, moving on. Comments from the public. Colleen, you've got your hand up. So.
Thank you. Very quickly, I think starting with an education would really be great. I know that the city of Port Angeles has asked for the EDC to put together stakeholder meetings on their behalf, and the city of Port Angeles is dictating what the agenda will be, and it's certainly starting with here's 101 of BPA contracts and limitations and, you know, restrictions and you know, the process. And if you'd like to have the Clallam PUD be a part of that, to hit all of it at once, I could certainly make that happen if you'd prefer. And you could work with Thomas Hunter on that process if you want, or do it separately, whatever you think is the most appropriate. But I've just heard, as we've tried to pursue different businesses and came up against barriers based on the BPA contracts, the question has been, is it possible to modify that in the next contract period? Or maybe the answer is nope, it's not possible. But to hear what the barriers have been might be of value to you before you begin the negotiations.
Well, I guess, you know, City of Port Angeles is a separate utility with separate needs, separate customer base, and so on. So I'm not too sure you could meld those two into one session. But anyway, thanks for your comment. Are there others, T?
Yes, there appears to be, unless that is still, I'm not seeing who that is. If there's someone else other than Colleen that would like to give public comment, please state your name. That was Colleen. She took her hand down. So I don't see any other comments.
Okay, good. So that's comments on that. We've got an action item. There is no executive session, so if there's no other business to come before the board, we stand adjourned. Thank you for your participation.
Thank you.